Begin. We lost some people over the break. Maybe they're still wandering back to the Berkeley campus. We have one announcement.
Hi, everyone. Can you all hear me in the back?
Yeah.
Cool. All right, so I'm here from the Society of Hong Kong and Chinese Affairs, and we're having a professor talk day after tomorrow. That's the 31st of March. And the reason I'm announcing it to your class is because I'm assuming that since you're here, you are interested in economics and or the environment. Yes?
Yay.
I hope so. We are having a talk from Professor David Roland Holst, and he's from the Economics Department and the Agricultural Resource and Economics Department. And he'll be talking about China's growth and sustainability challenges and its global implications. And I was really hoping that a few of you might be interested, so I have a bunch of flyers here. The talk is day after tomorrow at 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., and refreshments will be served there. So if anyone's interested, I'll just be like sort of making my way to the back of the class as I leave, and you can raise your hand and I'll pass flyers down your row. Does that sound good? Cool. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Today, these are the issues that we're going to cover. A fundamental question is, what is the relationship between some future flow versus current flows? In what fashion do interest rates make future flows comparable to current flows? What is the appropriate discount rate, which we'll define, for analyzing public projects? What is benefit-cost analysis? You know, quite simply, benefit-cost analysis is a full employment act for economists. All regulatory bodies, all governmental bodies, whenever there's a new project or a new regulation that's put in place, they are required to do a benefit-cost analysis. And generally speaking, the discipline that has the expertise to perform such benefit-cost analysis are economists. There is a society for benefit-cost analysts. There is a journal of benefit-cost analysis. So it is an important area of inquiry, which we're going to cover today. And moreover, you should keep in mind, too, that during President Reagan's administration in 1981, an executive order was signed which said OMB. OMB stands for the Office of Management and Budget. So it controls governmental expenditures. OMB must perform a benefit-cost analysis on each and every regulation that is advanced, any new regulations that are advanced by the federal government. What are the methods to compare? There are three different methodologies out there. One is referred to as net present value. The second is benefit-cost ratio. The third is internal rate of return. And we'll distinguish these three different methodologies today. But before we go there, let's just make it as simple as we possibly can. And in that regard, Brian, you with me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to give you a choice, but I'm going to ask someone to be an economic consultant to advise you, all right?
Okay.
And the choice is you get $100 today, right, versus $150 10 years from now. Now, we know right from the get-go, they're not directly comparable, right? Because $100 today, you can take that, you can spend it, you can invest it, do whatever. And if you're not going to get the $150 for 10 years, first of all, we don't know what you're going to be doing in 10 years. Maybe you do, but most people don't know what they're going to be doing in 10 years. So, Chen, you with me?
Yeah.
I want you to advise Brian about how he should make that choice. Should he take $100 today or wait for 10 years to get $150? Yes? So you've got to advise him. You can't just tell him it depends on. You've got to tell him what to do. Otherwise, he doesn't need you, right?
I would take $100 now because I'm a fan of, like,
I see. Okay, so do you want to engage a new economic consultant or go with that advice?
Well, I was going to take the one advice
anyway. So. Yeah. So he's just confirmed it for you.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, that's basically what we're talking about when we're looking at present value analysis. We're trying to make flows of value comparable. And there are all sorts of dimensions. Chen Chen mentioned two of them. What's going to happen to the currency? That is to say, is the currency in which you're going to get paid, will that currency be worth less in the future because of what, Chen Chen? Inflation, exactly. And the other factor that he mentioned was interest rate. Because if you took the $100 today, you could invest that $100 at some rate of return, right? And the simplest way to think about that, although today you wouldn't want to do it, but under normal circumstances, you could put it into a savings account. And the question is, what would you get in the way of an interest for a savings account? In today's world, you get next to nothing. But hopefully that's just temporary. And that's in large part because of the financial crisis that occurred in 2008 and interest rates today are very low, so the opportunity cost is very low today if you're measuring it using an interest rate associated with a savings account. But there are other benchmarks that one can use as well, and the benchmarks you should be using should be based on what your opportunity cost is, and we'll attempt to explain that. So these are the basic questions with regard to the issue that we just put on the table. The principle today is the $100. There's some interest payment that is made over a period of time. That's the second bullet here. And moreover, there is some future value. And what I specified, that simple example, is the future value is $150, right? 10 years out, it's $100. And the relationship between the future value is it must be equal to the principal, whatever the principal amount is, and that is expanded at the going rate of interest that you're going to receive on that principal. Right. Let's look at a simple, straightforward example. The principal is assumed here in this example to be $100. All right. Let's presume as well that the interest rate is 5%, hence the future value 1 year out, if I take $100 and put it into a savings account and I get 5% interest, at the end of 12 months, it's going to be worth $105. Right? And 10 years from now, expanding that same logic, 10 years from now, that particular $100, I'm going to compound this annually, and it's going to turn out to be $162. Right? So if your interest rate was 5%, then Chen Chen advising Brian should have said, don't do it, because you can do better by taking the $100, investing it at 5%, and it's going to be worth $162, not $150. Right? Okay? All right, continuing with that same logic, the future value, when I'm mapping from a current value to a future value, I am going to accumulate all of the interest. But also, I want a measure that allows me to compare different alternatives. And now, instead of compounding, I want a discount. That is to say, if I look at a stream of future flows and I want to say, okay, I'm looking at five different options and each of them have different streams of flows, how do I make them comparable? Like one may, for example, not return anything for 5 years, but it returns a large amount. Another alternative might return an even flow over the first 5 years. Now, how do I make them comparable? I make them comparable by computing the present value, which is at the end of this slide, and the present value for any future flow, this is the future value, I discount it to get what its present value is. So it's very simple. All you're doing is you're taking a principle, mapping it into what future flows you can capture, and you can take those future flows and discount them back to the present value. Right? So they are, as the second bullet suggests here, discounting is the reverse of compounding. That's all it is. But discounting results in a present value of future flows. And moreover, the time value of money is, in fact, the mechanism for doing that discounting. So coming back to our simple example, if the interest rate is 5%, we can take the present value of any flow in the future and discount that back to today. So if I'm looking at a flow 1 year out, and that turns out to be $105, I discount that back, and surprise, surprise, I get $100, which is exactly what I got when I went in the opposite direction, moving from the principal to a future value, right? And if I'm looking at the prior example, when I was accumulating, instead now I'm going to discount. I've got the $162.89, and I want to discount that to today, namely, what is the present value for some payment that occurs 10 years out, right, in which the interest rate is 5%. And if that interest rate is 5%, that's going to give me back the $100 principal that I began with. Okay? And by the way, this present value analysis, for those of you who have looked at discounted cash flow analysis, this is a common metric that's used by accountants when they look at a flow of value or in financial engineering. Frequently, you've got complicated flows with regard to an investment that might be made, and you go through that process of taking that cash flow, discounting it back to a current date. And only by doing that can you achieve direct comparability, but you can't do it unless you know what the opportunity cost is of the principal. And here we're presuming that opportunity cost is a savings rate. Now, why do we care about the time value of money? In many environmental projects, and by the way, it's not just environmental projects, it's any investment that any company makes, any individual consumer makes, when they make an investment, they're going to have to achieve comparability, and they're going to have to come to a conclusion about what the opportunity cost is of their principal or their current capital. So, but with regard to environmental policy, it's also important there in large part because when you're looking at different projects, they're going to have different time profiles with regard to the costs that are incurred and or the benefits that are generated, or the net cash flows. And as a result, you will be using this methodology of taking the future costs and benefits and discounting them back to the present. And only then can we achieve comparability and make an accurate choice with regard to the alternatives that we're faced with. Okay. Net present value. Quite simply, it's nothing more than the present value of future benefits less the present value of all the costs that you incur to capture those benefits. Now, if that net present value is positive, that suggests the project is worth undertaking in large part because it means that the stream of future benefits, once they're discounted back to the present, are larger than the stream of future costs discounted back to present. And that's an efficiency criteria as well. Just like when we looked at efficiency criteria with regard to maximizing total surplus, this criteria now is only complicated by the fact that you've got a time dimension and you're looking at flows over some future period of time and you want to make that comparable, but it's still an efficiency criteria. Okay, let's take a concrete example, make it more realistic. Suppose you're advising a sibling or your parents about whether or not they should make an investment in double pane windows insulation that's going to save them energy. And they have a PG&E bill that they pay, and suppose it turns out the facts reveal that if they incur a cost today of $4,047, their utility bill will drop on an annual basis by $740 per year. Right? So now you've got the dimension, you know what the cost is, and the cost is you're incurring all the cost up front. So that cost is its present value, right? But the benefits that you're going to be able to capture as a result of incurring that cost, that's going to occur over some period of time into the future. Okay? Now, we have to know what the opportunity cost of the money is. What could I have done? What could I do with the $4,047? To simplify, let's presume that this household could put that $4,047 into a savings account and get 5%. All right? We can complicate it, but we'll lose the insight about how one applies present value analysis to make streams comparable. So there's the 5%, which is the opportunity cost. And now the question is, how long will you be able to capture that decrease in energy cost or utility bill, which is the benefit? And if you look at, as your textbook suggests, homeowners generally stay in a house on average 7 years. So let's presume we're going to look at just 7 years. Now, should the owner make the investment or not? Joshua, should the owner make the investment?
Yes.
Why? Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
They don't make up the difference on interest, but they save more by giving the utility bill.
That turns out to be true, but can you give me a little more in the way of framework so I know your intuition is correct?
Okay, so they put the $4,000 in the bank, 5%.
Right. Right?
And that's
yeah, but you can't do 744 by 7, can you? Yeah, but you can't do 744 by 7, can you? That's a good point. No. Stop and think about it for a moment. The 744 in each year is not... 744 in year 3 is not the same as 744 in year 5. So you can't... You can't add them, which is what you were doing in your intuition, right? Dimitri, why can't you add them?
Because the value changes from year to year.
The time value of money. The value changes from 1 year to another. So when we go, your intuition is right, Joshua. But we have to take that 744, as Dimitri just suggests, and we have to discount it back to the present. So 1 year out, I've got to discount the 744 by 105, reflecting the opportunity cost of the investment I would make in the windows to save energy. And if I go out 7 years, I've got to discount the 745 by an even larger number, right? Because it's worth less. That 744 7 years out is worth much less than 744 in year one. And that turns out to generate benefits, and Joshua was right, his intuition was right, namely, he's going to get more benefit than the present value of his costs, because the present value of the benefits is going to be 4,305. The present value of the cost is going to be 4,047. Hence, the net present value is positive. And it's positive by $258, which is another way of saying that this household would make $258 more by investing in the windows than they would by putting that same amount of money into a savings account. Right? Okay? Does that make sense? All right. So the homeowner should make the investment. Now, this is for an opportunity cost of 5% per year. And it turns out that the interest rate is critical. Why is it critical? As in the first lecture, one of the fundamental principles of economics is one of the critical costs is the opportunity cost that you face. Now, if the interest rate, let me explain this graph. I've got on the horizontal axis, and this comes right out of your textbook reading for today. This is the horizontal axis, and time is measured in years. So when you're reading across this axis, it goes out to 100 years. And then on the vertical axis is the computed present value for any flows that you might want to look at. Right? So if the interest rate or the opportunity cost of capital is only 2%, when we get out to 100 years, the present value is still fairly sizable. Right? Reading across to the vertical axis. Suppose, however, that the interest rate were 8%. If you look at 8%, what happens is the 8% discounts future values more and more. Right? Because you're raising that to an exponent. And it turns out that you're going to lower whatever future values take place. And for 8%, if we look at this particular curve, we'll see that when we get to year 60, even though there may be a positive flow at year 60, it has no value today. Does that make sense? Okay. So what's the conclusion of this graph? The conclusion of this graph is that as your opportunity cost goes up in this simple graph from 2 to 8% via a curve that I've got up there at 5%, as that happens, you're going to place increasingly less value on future flows. So that's going to, as interest rates go up, your intuition ought to tell you as it goes up, that means you're going to have more willingness to invest in short-term payouts. Okay? You need the money sooner because your opportunity cost is so high. All right. Okay, let's take a second example and let's change the facts. Everything is the same as it was, but now the opportunity cost of capital is 10%, not 5%. Okay? Melissa, help me. Okay, your intuition is good, but now tell me why. No, come on, don't give up on me. Come on. You know, your logic was going in the right direction. Keep it going.
It'll pay for itself sooner by installing.
Now, you took a detour there. You took a detour. Don't give up. Don't give up. Please don't give up.
I really don't know.
Yes, you do. No, you started with a... You started with the right answer, and then you start digging a hole. The old story about when you're digging a hole, stop digging. Come back to your original statement. You said that if it's 10%, then the opportunity cost, or you, I'm adding a little bit to what you said. But nevertheless, you said that the 10%, you said you wouldn't make the investment in the windows. Didn't you say that at the outset?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the right answer.
I know, but I don't really know why. I only know because you just said it.
No, but given the logic that we've used up to this point in time, because it now I can end up earning more by putting the money in a savings account than I can by incurring a cost of $4,047 to install these double pane windows. So what it shows is, you know, we all would prefer to engage in everything else constant. We would all prefer to engage in energy conservation, right? But here's an illustration where you go through the actual economic logic and you find that if the opportunity cost is very high, twice as high as it was in the prior example, when you go through the actual computation, here, if we look at the present value of benefits, now we're discounting that $740 each of those years at a much larger value, right? We're dividing by a much larger value. Okay? And as a result, the present value of benefits turns out to be much lower than it was in the first case. And the present value of cost is now here, remaining the same, because that's all incurred right out of the box, right, instantaneously. And thus, when I do the computation of what is the net present value, I end up with a negative number. So if I'm rational, I'm not going to invest in the energy conservation. Instead, I'm going to invest the $4,047 at 10%, and I'm going to be better off. Okay? Yes? Yes?
I just want to make sure I understand something. So, like, we don't include in this calculation, like, let's say if you took that $4,047 and invested that for 7 years, because you're losing that as well. But the reason we're not doing that is because we're looking at the present value of like,
right. But yes, but what I'm telling you, Hillary, that lying behind this actual computation, you're comparing whenever you're doing this kind of evaluation, implicitly you're comparing it to another alternative. And the other alternative is embedded in whatever you presume the discount rate is, or the interest rate. And that discount rate, if you look at the computation on the present value at the top of this particular graph, that particular denominator here has embedded in it the 10%, right? So basically, even though we're not saying, okay, we're looking at two options here, taking the money, investing in a savings account to 10% versus investing in this energy conservation. All we're doing is looking at the energy conservation, but embedded in that problem is the opportunity cost of my capital, which is presumed to be 10%. And that wouldn't be a relevant opportunity cost of capital unless you could actually capture it, right? Okay. Yes?
Each term in that.
Yes, at the top, yeah. Here? Yes.
It shows the value of 744 at that year. Is that what it is that you're adding?
But each term there's seven of them, right? Okay, there's seven terms here. I haven't written them all out, but there's seven terms here. But what I'm taking for each flow in each year, I'm saving $740 on my energy bill each year. Okay, I get to the end of the year, I've got $740 more than I would have had if I didn't make the investment. Okay, in the windows, right? Okay, so for the first year, I discount this back to get its present value, right? And if I go to the second year, now I'm going to discount it by 1.1 to the exponent 2, right? and all the way and continuing that same fashion out to the seventh year. And now I've got to apply an even heavier discount because it's 7 years out.
No, I
understand. The reason, because this comes back to our first example, Chen Chen versus Brian, right? Okay, 10 years out, $150 versus $100 today. We discovered that when that is discounted at 5%, you could actually, if you took the 100 today, you could actually have $162 at the end of 10 years, right? But if I had $162 at 10 years out, to make it comparable today, I've got to discount that back to today. And if I'm discounting at 5%, it's going to be $100. If I'm discounting at 10%, it's going to be much lower than that. Right? Yes?
So is it 10%, like how much
money is depreciating? No, not yet. By the way, we'll get to depreciation in terms of real versus nominal values, but we're not there yet. This is just, don't make it too complicated. It's not the value of money depreciating. It's that I have an opportunity cost whenever I make a choice. And the interest rate in this example represents my opportunity cost. Because instead of making this investment, the windows, I can put the money in a savings account, and now I'm assuming in this example, coming back to the prior chart, that the interest that I could capture is 10%. Okay? Don't make it any more complicated than that. Yes?
So
Carly?
Is that for the $100 example, that would be the same thing you use for the $100?
Yes. 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 Yep. Yep. Instead of getting $5 at the end of 1 year, I'm going to get interest of $10, and I'm going to have $110 instead of $105. It's as simple as that. Okay. All right. Now we're going to go on to the complication about whether the value of the currency, whether it's holding its value or not, whatever the monetary units are. And in different parts of the world, we all know there are different monetary units. But we're talking about dollars here, generally speaking. And there's a question about nominal versus real. Everything that we've covered up to this particular slide, we've presumed that we're looking at nominal dollars. Right? But you say, and some of you implied in the exchange that we've had thus far, gee whiz, $150 10 years from now isn't the same as $150 today. Forget about your opportunity cost of capital. It's not the same, right? Because if the rate of inflation, what happens is the rate of inflation goes up with regard to the $150 10 years from now versus $150 today. Pardon? It's worth less. It's worth, and as the inflation increases, that means that you are going to place less value on money that you're going to get way out in the future versus money today. So I want to make a correction for that. And by the way, look at the countries talking about inflation to bring this to a real set of circumstances. Go to Germany prior to the Nazi regime. And they, in Germany, their inflation rate was above 1,000% per year. Guess what? No one wants to hold money. Go to Argentina right after World War II and look at their rate of inflation. Nobody wants to hold money because tomorrow a loaf of bread may end up costing three times what it costs today. So people are going to exchange whatever currency they're holding for real goods and do it as soon as possible. And it has the paradox of making the situation worse. Right? Because if no one wants, if the currency has no store of value, then they're going to transfer out of the currency into goods, real goods, that have a store of value. And in doing so, they're going to drive up the prices of those goods in the short run, making inflation even worse. All right? So, all we have to do with regard to the kind of analysis that we conduct in economics is recognize that there's some depreciation in the value of the currency, and we want to take that into account. But what I want you to remember, if you do that, if you look at the flows, and they're all nominal terms, they're not inflation adjusted, right? By the way, you didn't have a hard break, did you? You okay?
Yeah.
No, I'm actually talking to the young lady behind you. I know you're okay. Are you okay?
Yeah,
good, good. Well, I just saw you dozing off a few times. I want to make sure you were with us. Okay. But no, earlier. Did I have that wrong? I did? Okay. Coming back to the real values, all right? When I'm looking at adjusting nominal dollars, because most of us are concerned about dollars, and I make adjustments for the real value, I must also adjust the discount rate. It's got to be a real value as well. So how do we do that? The interest rate, the 5 and the 10% that we've looked at up till now, those were nominal rates too. Because if I put my capital into a savings account, and let's suppose I'm getting 10%, all right? But let's suppose the rate of inflation is 3%. Am I really getting 10%? So I go to the local bank, all right? And I put my funds in a savings account, and they said, "You're very lucky. You're going to get 10% per year, but we're going to accumulate this 10%. We're not going to pay it till this particular saving account matures. And let's suppose it matures in 5 years, all right? So I get to the end of the 5 years. And I look at this and say, gee whiz, I got 10% the first year, I got $10. Then I got the next year 10%, $110, right? I accumulate that forward. And I look at this and say, gee whiz, that's a very nice rate of return. But suppose, let's take a concrete example. Suppose the rate of inflation is 10%. Have I made anything at all? No, I haven't made anything at all. So if I'm going to take the flows of benefits and cost and transform them from nominal values to real values, I must do the same for the interest rate and or the discount rate. Otherwise, I'm not going to achieve comparability. And moreover, whenever someone, here we go again, whenever, Quack, wake up. whenever, you're looking at the opportunities and you're saying, well, wait a minute, I have to, since I'm looking at future values, there's other dimensions of adjustment that I must make as well. Because the underlying currency, its value can change too. So the real rate of interest, as I think we've just established, is the difference between the nominal rate of interest, which is over here that I've got here, use real prices, and if you do so, you've got to use the real interest rate, and the real interest rate is whatever the interest rate is minus the rate of inflation. And I think we just explored that when we went through the examples of what would happen if I captured an interest rate of 10%, but the rate of inflation was 10%, it's a wash, okay? Because the real interest rate would be zero. Yes? Oh, CPI is Consumer Price Index, and that is a standard measure of inflation here in the United States and in most other countries as well. It's measured at the consumer level. It's the basket of goods that a typical household purchases, and how much does the value of the currency depreciate over time with regard to the real goods, okay? That's what it is. It's called the Consumer Price Index. There's a producer price index. It's upstream, not at the consumer level, but at the manufacturing level. But it's really a metric to tell you what the underlying rate of inflation is. Okay? Okay. other interest rates, borrowing versus savings. If you go to a bank and you offer your capital to that bank, they pay you a certain rate, but then they lend that money out. Do they charge the borrowers the same interest rate that they pay you? No, because if they did, they wouldn't be an ongoing enterprise, right? They incur costs, they have labor, they have capital that they have to employ. So there's a gap between the rate that a saver receives versus the interest rate that a borrower has to pay. And quite clearly, and if you look at credit cards, for example, most credit cards, not all, but most credit cards, if you look at the actual lending rate, it can be as high as 25%, right? But those people who are lending or placing their capital with banks are not getting anything resembling that particular lending rate. So those are some rates to keep in mind, and it's just the separation between borrowing and saving with regard to the rates. Now, there's a host of interest rates out there. We've just used it in terms of examples. There is, quite obviously, different risk associated with how you use your capital. If you put your capital with the U.S. government, that is viewed to be the least risky savings account, in effect, that you can invest in. If you look at the 5-year Treasury bill today, the interest rate you get on a 5-year Treasury bill is approximately 2%. Okay? At the height of the financial crisis, that rate was down at 0.5 point. And moreover, if you looked at short-term Treasury bills, in December of 2008 through March of 2009, short-term Treasury bills, a one-week Treasury bill, guess what? People were paying the government interest to park their principal. And you say, wait a minute, how could that possibly be rational? Right? Fear. Fear of the unknown, the risk associated with protecting your principal and making sure that you don't lose your principal. It's one thing to lose the return on the principal, but any time, by the way, this only happened for a short period. There was only 4 months where it existed. And you knew right away there was an arbitrage opportunity, unless the world was coming to an end, right? Because it's just not rational for people to take their scarce capital and put it into what's an equivalent to a savings account and pay the bank to hold the money. It doesn't make sense. So anyway, the lowest rate out there is the Treasury bills, Treasury bonds. And the reason that's the case is because the view is it's the lowest risk alternative. Corporate bonds, junk bonds, the interest rates are much higher. They're higher because there's greater risk of not getting paid the interest rate or the return. So if you look at the quality of bonds that are out there, you'll find the interest rate being a positive function of the risk. And it should be. Because there is a risk that the counterparty, whoever is committed to pay you an interest over some future period of time, may default. And if they default, they won't pay you anything. In fact, they may walk away with your principal. You may lose your principal as well. Okay. Other potential sources for the opportunity cost of capital, up till now, we've referred to this as the interest rate. But if you're looking at, gee whiz, I can invest in the S&P 500. Right? I can put my scarce capital there. Another is a Russell 2000. And there's indexes all over the place that you can invest in today. They're ETF, which are exchange-traded funds, and you can invest in all of those. And if that is your relevant alternative, you look at what kind of rate of return you're going to get for that investment versus the present value of some project you're looking at, the net present value, right? the reason I'm doing this, I don't want you to believe that there is one interest rate out there that matters. What really matters at the end of the day is what is the opportunity cost of your capital. Okay, risk. And your book discusses this. If you look at different periods of time, particularly if you look at the post-World War II period, stocks gave a higher return than bonds. Two alternative types of investments, right? If you look at other periods of time, you'll find the opposite situation. If you look at the period 2007 through to early 2010 in this country and in certainly all other industrialized countries, bond returns were much higher than stock returns, which is easy because many of the stock or equity values plummeted during the financial crisis. Anyway, now the point here, the most important opportunity cost of capital that each of you have is your human capital, is what you're investing in right now as an undergraduate at Berkeley. And that is the most important part of the value that you're going to create for yourself going forward. And there's a risk in that as well, right? But nevertheless, your lifetime income will be more dependent on your human capital than it will be on some lucky investment that you made in the stock market. So, now, there's risk in all sorts of investments, and that risk can be diversified, and a few bullets here just illustrate that you can diversify to some degree. If you look at chip makers, and there are two principal companies out there making chips, Intel and AMD, and to some degree they move in opposite directions depending on how successful one company is versus another because they're direct competitors. So if one company is doing really well and if the size of the market is fairly stable, then another one must not be doing so well. So investing in both allows you to diversify but also limits your upside rate of return. This discussion all goes to what is the opportunity cost of your capital, right? Okay. Now, more seriously, looking particularly at environmental economics and investing in public goods, what discount rate should be used? It certainly shouldn't be what an individual household gets on their savings account, right? And you'll find in your textbook a debate about what is the appropriate discount rate for public projects. You want to build a dam, and there are all sorts of benefits that flow from that. Generally speaking, all the costs are up front, so they're easy to discount and measure. But once again, if your interest rate is very high, and the benefit side of the equation in the net present value equation, net present value of benefits less net present value of costs, if the first term is all based on a lot of future flows, but the second term, the cost, is all right now, clearly as interest rates go up, you're going to find yourself unwilling to pursue a lot of projects, right? And that's what I'm trying to illustrate through this particular graph right here. And when we look at and say this high interest rates, low interest rates, we understand what the qualitative effects are, but at the end of the day, what is the right interest rate? Which one should be used? Now, the one that should be used is a social discount rate. So, if you don't know what it is, call up your elected representative and say, tell me, what's the social discount rate? What do you think that elected representative is going to tell you? I mean, that representative is there attempting to fashion the allocation of scarce resources for public good projects, for decisions that are made with regard to environmental conservation, with regard to protecting the environment. And I ask you, call President Obama. Ask him what the social discount rate is. What is he going to tell you? He frequently, if you listen to President Obama, he frequently makes presentation when they ask him a hard question. He said, we're going to have to do a benefit-cost analysis. And we're going to have to take into account all the benefits. We're going to have to look at all the costs, and we'll get this sorted out. We'll make a choice. You can't do that without knowing what the social discount rate is. I've just shown you in the prior slides, you can't get there unless you know what your opportunity cost of capital, or in this case, the opportunity costs associated with governmental budgets. Right? So, there is a great debate. There is no, I don't know of any politician that's going to be able to tell you what the social discount rate is. If you go to any agency of our federal government and you go to OMB and you ask them what their discount rate is, and they say, it's no problem, it's published right here, it's 7%. Right? Go to the Department of Interior. You know, they're in the business of preserving. They're responsible for Yellowstone Park, National Park, Yosemite. And you ask them, what's your social discount rate? It's not going to be 7%. You go to the EPA, and you ask them what their discount rate is when they look at different projects. They have still a different discount rate. Every governmental agency has a different discount rate. And moreover, many of those discount rates are conditioned on what are the market rates. And as market rates move, for example, given the illustration I just gave you, in 2008 and 2009, interest rates plummeted in this country. And when they plummeted, does that mean that you would adjust all the other interest rates, particularly the social discount rate? Now, let's bring this home in a real active debate. Here are two economists, well-known, well-recognized economists. Let me give you a little bit of background before I go through this example. When I was on the Council of Economic Advisors, this was 1986-87, and the first significant observation of what was happening to the ozone layer became common knowledge in 86-87. So we were given the assignment to look at what investment should be made by the U.S. government to reverse the decrease in the ozone layer. Okay? And when you looked at all the science, it became clear that there wasn't going to be any real significant harm to human health for another 100 years. At the time, this is 86, 87, regardless of whether it's 100 years or 50 years. Now, if you're operating with a discount rate of 10%, or 8%, or 7%, okay, would you do anything today? Because even if I put value on the degradation of human health 50 years out, if you've got a high discount rate today, I don't care. When I get close enough and it has some real value, then I'll do something. So we spent a lot of time looking at this question, and it brought us right back to the issue about what is the appropriate social discount rate. And if you can imagine the people surrounding Reagan, they would have preferred a very high discount rate, because that means they didn't have to do anything today. Because we can continue to allow economic growth to unfold, and we're not going to constrain economic growth. But once you recognize that a high social discount rate meant that you would sit on your hands for a long period of time before you attempted to do anything of significance, even Reagan stepped forward and said, no, this can't be the right answer. This cannot be the right answer. Hence, this comes to the Stern-Norhaus debate. Nicholas Stern is an Englishman, and he basically did this study looking at global warming. And he said, gee whiz, what should be the social discount rate? And he basically argued it should be zero. Why should it be zero? Because it's equitable to treat future generations with the same weight as the current generation. That's his argument. Nordhaus comes along and says, wait a minute, there's a real opportunity cost of capital. Namely, instead of expending those funds today for protecting ourselves against global warming, instead we should use these scarce resources and invest them in getting a higher rate of return, and use that higher rate of return somewhere down the road to make the investments that we need to make. In other words, he's arguing that the social discount rate should be based on the opportunity cost of capital, not of the government, but of the taxpayers who are writing out checks to the government, because they're the ones who ultimately are going to finance any investments that are going to be made to solve the global warming problem. So this is an active debate that is ongoing within the profession and in governments, as well as the public sector grapples with this issue, trying to decide what should be done today. Okay. Now, let's turn to benefit-cost analysis. It is the criteria for public projects, and it is, as I've already shown in a simple example, it's the net present value. That's one metric that's out there. And looking at a concrete example, and this is an example that's in your book, where they look at investing in a dam, and it's a public project. Army Corps of Engineers are the ones who construct dams throughout the country. And the question is, do the benefits outweigh the cost? Estimating the cost, you've got to include all the cost, including environmental damages. Now, that's true when the public sector makes the investment, but it's not true necessarily when the private sector does, right? Because the private sector wouldn't take into account the external cost unless there was corrective taxes that were being imposed on them. Right? Now, some of the environmental costs are listed here. You put a lot of land that's formerly productively used to grow food. It's now underwater. And there's all sorts of examples of issues associated with loss of diversity, endangered species. In fact, there was a major dam construction development in the Tennessee Valley that was delayed something like 35 years, in part because of of an endangered species that was located in the area that they were going to cover with water. Okay, now, the methodologies. There are three methodologies, as I suggested at the outset. One we've already discussed, the net present value, and whenever that's positive, you pick the one with the highest net present value. And that's going to give you efficiency. Anna Sophie?
Sorry, just going back to initially you said that the costs all come now for the dam, but I'm a little confused about how because we can predict that like these things are going, like species loss, things like that, like I feel like there are environmental aspects of cost that would come right away. Like are we're factoring them in?
Right. Right. By the way, if I said that, I apologize. I don't mean, it doesn't, in many of the examples we looked at, the simple example about installing the windows, all that cost comes up front. A lot of the costs don't all come up front. And wherever they come, you have to take in, you should be taking them into account. And if they occur at different points in the future, you've got to present value them. Right? Yeah. Yeah. If I said that, I apologize. Okay. Now, the first method, net present value. And you pursue those that give you the highest net present value, which is equivalent to maximizing the net present value. And you know if the marginal benefits are larger than the marginal cost, you should continue that project until what? They're equated, right? Same principle. Okay, there's a second method out there, which is the benefit-cost ratio. And you say, well, wait a minute, what do I need this for? If the net present value is positive, then the benefit-cost ratio must be greater than 1, right? Because all it is the present value of benefits divided by the present value of cost. And that's shown here, right here in this particular equation. If it's greater than 1, then it follows immediately that I'm gaining more in the way of present value of benefits than I'm losing with regard to present value of cost. Okay? Now, can you use these two different metrics interchangeably? And the answer is no. And your book points this out. In large part, it depends on whether you have unlimited funding or you have restricted funding. If you have unlimited funding, then the right methodology is just to maximize benefits less cost. And by the way, this B is the present value of all benefits, and this C is the present value of all costs. And it is the appropriate methodology, particularly when you're looking at mutually exclusive projects. However, if you have a fixed budget and you only have so many dollars available, then an appropriate criteria, particularly if you're looking at projects that are not mutually exclusive, then the benefit-cost ratio is a reasonable metric and or methodology to use. Now, I've got a concrete example here, and this is taken from your book, the reading for today. I've called this here small dam, but in your book it says levees. So you're trying to control flooding in some basin. And you can put levees up or you can construct a large dam. That's the second alternative. Okay? So let's suppose that if we're looking at the net present value of benefits for the small dam, it's $20 million, the cost are $10 million, you get a present net value of $10 million. Right? If you go to the large dam, however, you generate $35 million of benefits, $20 million of cost for a net present value of $15 million. Now, using the first metric, namely maximizing net present value, you would choose the large dam because you get a higher net present value, right? But if you look at the benefit-cost ratio, the benefit-cost ratio for the small dam is 2, and the benefit-cost ratio for the large dam is 1.75. Now you say, wait a minute, they're not giving me the same answer, right? Why aren't they giving me the same answer? Once again, that's because if I'm not constrained by funding, that is to say I can spend $20 million or I can spend $10 million, there's no constraint. Under those circumstances, I should be using the first methodology, namely maximizing net present value. However, if there's limited funds, for example, suppose I only have $10 million, then the benefit-cost ratio works. It will give you the right answer. At the very bottom of this particular slide, I note that if you had a budget constraint of $100 million, then you would be better off, since they're not mutually exclusive projects, you would be better off investing 10 small because you'll generate more in the way of net present value than you would if you built 5 large ones. In particular, if you built 5 large ones, just quite simply, 5 times 15 is what? $75 million. And 10 times 10 is $100 million. So you're better off building 10 small ones than you are building 5 large ones. It's just important to keep that in mind. I'm not going to expect you to be faced with a problem, maybe on a problem set, but certainly not on the final exam, where you're going to get different outcomes by using the benefit-cost ratio versus maximizing net present value. Yes?
Yeah, I was just going to say, does anyone ever use the TMD since unlimited funding is not really irrational? I mean, is there such thing as unlimited funding for a project? Are they always assuming the benefit-cost ratio because that's...
Well, there is instances where you're looking at a particular project, and if it gives you lots of benefits, the view is, particularly if it's a public-private partnership, because you can get enough contribution from the private arm to be able to finance it if there's enough return. Okay, yeah. All right. Their third methodology is what's referred to as an internal rate of return. And it's important that you go through the logic of this, not because you're going to be faced with being tested by this a question related to this methodology. But instead, if you go through it and think about it and understand it, you'll understand everything else that we've discussed in this lecture. An internal rate of return is the rate of return that you compute as an unknown in this equation. Namely, I'm going to take the present value of all benefits, equate it to the present value of all cost, and make the unknown what's the rate of return, or the interest rate, or the discount rate, or here, the internal rate of return, that makes the two sides of the equation equal. Okay? All right. But you don't stop there. Suppose you do this computation for a project and it turns out that you compute the internal rate of return and suppose it's 20%. Right? And you say, gee whiz, that's a very favorable internal rate of return. But if your opportunity cost of capital is 25%, namely you can invest your capital and get a return of 25%, should you pursue that project? Think about the logic. What do you think, Adam?
You wouldn't.
You would not. And why not?
Because you could make more money than you invested.
Exactly. Exactly. It's that simple. And in this little example here, the hurdle rate is just that. It would be whatever the opportunity cost of your capital is, and that would be your hurdle rate, and any internal rate of return that you computed must be larger than that if you're going to pursue the project. If it's less than that, you're going to walk away from the project. Okay. Now, there's an example in your book. I'm not going to spend a lot of time in lecture, but it goes through an MIT study that was done looking at all of the costs that are associated with investing in a nuclear power plant. And given what happened in Japan a few weeks ago, you may wonder why in the world would a group of MIT professors sit around and look at investing in a nuclear power plant. Well, they did it before the episode took place. That's one reason. That's the simplest explanation. And now, throughout the world, every country that has nuclear power plants generating electricity are evaluating the risk associated with some potential problem with regard to cooling the rods in those particular nuclear power plants. But it's instructive for you to go through this because it provides all the details associated with a stream of cost, how you would go about adjusting those costs, and determining what the present value is. And when you construct a nuclear power plant, by the way, the one thing that people say, oh, they're the low-cost plant, right? They're the low-cost source of electricity. But that's if and only if the plant is a sunk cost. If you look at the actual operating costs, nuclear power plants provide, in terms of incremental cost, the low-cost alternative. If you looked at a supply deck for electricity and you looked at nuclear power versus gas-fired plants versus coal plants, nuclear power would be at the very bottom, namely the most efficient. But only the most efficient because that's just the incremental cost. It doesn't take into account the investment cost, right? Now, what this study does is look at the investment cost, and it turns out for a 1,000 megawatt plant, that investment cost is sizable. It's $5.46 billion. And then they go through the process of looking at other costs, what's the present value of those. Namely, you've got to decommission the plant 40 years out. Then you've got to find a solution for where you're going to dispose of the nuclear waste. Do you know what the problems are with regard to disposing of nuclear waste in this country? Do you? The government had a solution. What's the mountain in Nevada? Yes. And guess what? Is there any nuclear waste there yet? Yes. And where's that nuclear waste now? Sitting at the plants, providing another source of risk for all of us. Nevertheless, decommissioning is a serious problem. Now, on the benefit side, You The benefits are you generate electricity. The question is, what do you get for that electricity? 10 cents per kilowatt hour. And natural gas is a lower cost. But it's a lower cost because you don't take into account. Let me back up. This study that was done by MIT was for a private investor, right? So if you did a natural gas plant or a combustion cycle plant, and you didn't have to pay for the carbon that was being emitted, then the natural gas plant is more efficient. When you look at the total investment cost plus what the benefits are going to be generated, however, if you put a price, a corrective tax that we've discussed, on the carbon emission, then the natural gas is not as favorable as a nuclear power plant. But now, with regard to costs, what about taking into account the risk of a failure of the nuclear power plant? Yes. Nuclear power? Because solar panel farms are 3 times more costly, number one. And number two, there wouldn't be one solar panel in this country but for governmental subsidies. That's why. That's why the government, as a representative democracy, is prepared to offer subsidies for solar panels and or wind-generated power, and moreover, offer huge subsidies for ethanol production as another source of feedstock for the generation, at least, of biofuels. By the way, this is an important discussion, and we will revisit the points that you've just made. But given that I have 6 minutes left, may I go on? I promise we'll come back to it, okay? Okay, I've got some other slides about nukes. The only point I want to make here with regard to the external cost, there are all sorts of external costs, and one of the great examples is a major nuclear power plant sitting on the Hudson River, which uses, as we all know and we've learned over the course of the last 3 weeks, you can't use salt water to cool a nuclear power plant. It's got to be fresh water. Unfortunately, the Japanese had no choice because they couldn't access any fresh water, and they attempted to cool the plant by using seawater, but en route they end up destroying the actual infrastructure of that plant because it can't handle the seawater. But nevertheless, talking about external costs, if you want to see real external costs, there is a nuclear power plant in Indiana Point in New York. It cycles 2.5 billion gallons per day through its cooling system. That one nuclear power plant uses more water than the entire city of New York. Okay? And what happens to that water? It gets heated. And it's discharged from the plant back into the Hudson River. Now, there's some external cost here, right? The fish are killed. They're caught in the screens associated with that recycling process. There's huge external cost. Not that there aren't external costs with regard to other forms of energy generation, but when we look at, it's easy to say, I want to look at the stream of benefits, I want to look at the stream of costs, and I want to take the present value of each of them. If you're going to make them directly comparable, you've got to take into account all the external costs and try to measure those as best you can. And in many cases, there's no market for that external cost, right? Which means you've got to go back to the methodologies that we discussed right after the midterm, the readings that you had on state preference, stated preference, and revealed preference to get some value with regard to those external costs. And we'll revisit that later. Now, benefit cost in practice. As I just indicated, it's straightforward. There's a big issue out there about the distribution of benefits and costs. If I'm just looking at the net present value of benefits less cost, it says nothing about the distribution. Suppose somebody bears all the cost and somebody else gets all the benefits. Well, it's still efficient, right? Just like if we have a perfectly discriminating monopolist who extracts all the consumer surplus from all the buy side, we say, hell, it's still efficient. It just so happens you don't like the equity outcome because the monopolist gets everything. Likewise, the whole focus on environmental justice goes just to this question. Because in the refinery plants, I've got an example here, oil refineries in Richmond, close by. All I have to do is travel on 80 East, those refinery plants. The question, as a policymaker, should you approve the project simply because the studies reveal that it passed the benefit cost analysis, namely net present value of constructing refinery plants there are positive? The answer is, and we don't have enough time to explore this, but the answer is no, you should look at the distributional impacts. Because if the residents surrounding those refineries bear all the cost, all the external cost associated with the disposal and the emission of pollutants into the atmosphere, they are the ones that suffer the most, then your benefit-cost analysis should accompany an actual distribution. Who bears the cost? Who captures the benefits? And is there a way of offering compensation and still capturing the efficient outcome with regard to the net present value of benefits versus cost? And then finally, cost-effectiveness analysis. Instead of doing a straight-up benefit-cost analysis, the presumption here with this methodology is you've got a target, you want to achieve the target at minimum cost. And as we discussed when we looked at air pollution, the EPA, in effect, set standards for ambient air quality. Now, the question is, how do we minimize cost of achieving that target? And that's what cost-effectiveness analysis attempts to do, and it's distinguishable from net present value or benefit cost ratio or internal rates of return. Why is it distinguishable? Because you're not trying to make a choice of the optimal amount. That choice has been made already, and all you want to do is achieve a pre-specified target at minimum cost. Okay? Thank you.